Coming up this Friday, there is an author visit and presentation at the Ketchikan Public Library. Joining us by phone, we have Jonathan White. His book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean, will be the topic of that discussion. Good morning to you.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah. I'm doing very well. Looking at this book, I think the title is appropriate, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. It seems to have a mix of a lot of technical information, but a lot of just storytelling as well.
That's right. In a lot of ways, it's really a sailor's exploration about the tides, but there's a lot of story in it. I go to a lot of places around the world, and I'm in the story. I'm writing from the first person, so I'm having an adventure and also exploring and talking with the people in these areas about their experience with the tides.
And before we get into the bulk of the book, can you give people a little information about yourself, about your background, both at the things you do, because I think part of it is interesting as well, is that you're a surfer, which probably influenced you on this, as well as a sailor, but also an author. So maybe just a little bit about you.
Yeah, I live on a small island in the San Juan Islands, just south of the Canadian border in Washington State, on Orcas Island, and I've actually spent a lot of time up in southeast Alaska. I used to run a large schooner up and down the coast doing seminars on the boat and spent a lot of time in southeast Alaska and the BC coast and so forth. But yes, I'm a sailor and a surfer, and I grew up on the California coast doing those things, and I've spent a lot of time in my adult life in marine and land conservation. And, of course, I'm a writer, and this is my second book, and I've written a number of articles, mostly about natural history, but philosophy and some other just pure science as well.
And why did you decide to delve into looking at tides?
Well, again, as a sailor, surfer, growing up on the coast, I felt like I always had a tide chart in my back pocket, like a lot of Alaskans, and then, you know, I almost lost that big old schooner up in a gale and large tide up in Killeen Bay, just north of Sitka in the early 90s. And the boat went down. I dragged anchor in the gale, and the boat went all the way down. And it got stuck in the mud. And when the tide came back up, the boat didn't come up, but the tide just filled the boat. And I nearly lost the boat. It was basically chest deep in water all the way through the cabins. And I came out of that experience figuring that, you know, it was time to learn about the tides. And like a lot of people, I knew the moon had something to do with it, but I wasn't sure what. And I thought that I would read a book or two and spend a couple of weeks and learn pretty much whatever there is to know about the tide, but I was really wrong. The more I read, the more complex, the more mysterious and fascinating and poetic the tides became. And so very quickly, you know, a couple of books and a couple of articles turned into 10 and then 50 and then 300 and a couple of weeks turned into 10 years.
Okay, I was going to ask you that, of how long it took you to explore all of this.
Yes, I mean, depends on how you look at it, but really from the very first, you know, interest and study on the tides, it's been 20 years, but a really intense research and writing for about 8 years.
And also not just looking at daily tide patterns, but you're also looking at so many other features related to different types of tides.
Yes. You know, it's one of the things, you know, I love reading textbooks, but what I didn't find in my research was a book that really brought in the human element. I mean, there's lots of really good, hard science about the tides, but nothing that really brings in that really rich, spiritual, mythological, cultural story. So that's the thing I wanted to bring in with the book, and then the reason that I decided to write the book. And I traveled all over the world and met lots and lots of people that have really deep relationships with the tide.
And that, I would say, the first several chapters in the book, that is what we see, is your interactions and relationships with the people and the people's relationships with the land. How did you decide on those locations And how were you able to meet up with the people you were able to?
Yeah, well, what I did basically was I took some element of the tide and I went to where that was dramatically at play in the world. So, for example, for the largest tidal bore in the world, and a tidal bore is when the tide comes up the river in the form of a wave or a solid wall of water. And there are, you know, close to 100 of these around. In fact, one up in Alaska and Cook Inlet and on the Amazon River. But what I did was I went to the largest one in the world, which is on the Chentong River in China, just south of Shanghai. And that tidal bore gets up to 25 feet. And it comes in on every tide twice a day, and it's done that for 2,500 years. So there's a lot of mythology and story and cultural history around this tide, as well as science. So so I went there, of course, and I spent some time, and then the chapter is wrapped around China and the Chentong River and tidal bores and what that means and how they work. And you know, the second part of your question, how did I meet up with these people? I just kept at it. And, you know, in a lot of cases, I had to go back to these places more than once to really get the story that I wanted, to get deep enough, to get contact with the people that I wanted to be in touch with. And, like, for example, in Mont-Saint-Michel, in the second chapter, I went there, and Mont-Saint-Michel is on the west side of France. And it's the largest tide in mainland Europe. It's 45 feet. And Mont-Saint-Michel is a Benedictine monastery that is perched on an island that gets completely tide-wrapped. So every high tide, it's a moat, basically. And then when the tide goes out almost 10 miles and over these flats. So it's a really extraordinary tide situation. And then there are these monks that live there that have dedicated their life to God. So I thought, of course, with the practice like that, the tides being such an incredible phenomenon there must influence their spiritual practice. So I wanted to interview them as part of that chapter, but they were really elusive. It took me 2 years with lots of letters back and forth to finally get permission. And they invited me to a silent lunch and a half-hour interview. So I got to pick the time. So I picked the largest tide of the year in winter, and I went, and I had my silent lunch, and the half-hour interview turned into an hour. And then that becomes the theme of that chapter about meeting these monks and what they had to say about the influence of the tide on their spiritual practice.
And maybe you could pick a short section that just gives a feel for your style of writing, if you'd be willing to do that. Just kind of give listeners a feel for what they can expect from the book.
That sounds good. Let me see. While I get to that spot, do you want to ask one other question? Oh, here we go. I found it.
Okay, great.
Okay. So this is actually from Mont-Saint-Michel and that second chapter that you mentioned. And I know tomorrow I will meet the monks, but tonight I ponder a letter sent earlier from Brother François-Marie. The abbey, he wrote, is a jewel set in a beautiful case, the bay. Isn't beauty a language through which God and mankind want to meet? If beauty is a language, then Mont-Saint-Michel is well-spoken tonight. At the western ramparts, where a couple hours ago I had watched the flood tide's advancing wave, I now study the ebb tide's fingers withdrawing in the inky light. I'm struck by the different voices I hear in the tide in the monastery. The abbey speaks of human achievement, built painstakingly in service to the archangel Michael, a guardian and dragon slayer. The monument is an eloquent testimony of humanity's insatiable desire for connection and belonging to God, to nature, to other humans. The stone heft speaks of permanence, a longing for the eternal. The tide is another kind of eloquence. It's the moon's voice on earth, spoken in perfect synchrony. What the moon does, the tide does. What the moon is, the tide is. Shifting by day but repeating a larger pattern, the tide mirrors the moon's paradox of change and changelessness. In its repetition, it personifies eternity. In its constant flux, it reminds us of what we can't control. It reminds us that our fortresses are impermanent.
Thank you. And with all of these places that you went to, it sounds as though, at least from reading the book, that you really were chasing the ideal situations to see all of these places at the highest tides. And I imagine that was complex.
Yes. I had an interesting project planning challenge because in a lot of these places I needed to go at a very specific time when the moon was at a particular phase or other conditions. And then there were a lot of them, of course. I went to China, as I mentioned, and Chile and Scotland, Venice, France, the Arctic, Bay of Fundy, BC, of course, Alaska, and so a lot of different, Panama. I was down in the San Blas Islands on the east side of Panama. So all these places had particular kind of timing needs. And so luckily I had a lot of time, and of course the project was spread out over many years. But it was a wonderful experience, and I one of the things that surprised me in all of it, and there's a very, very strong thread of science throughout the book, which is really the exploration of, how the tides work in, both in history and also contemporary. But I was surprised at the exquisite generosity of people, that all kinds of experts that were involved in this, that gave their time, both in peer reviewing the book and talking to me about all kinds of arcane things like vibration and resonance and tidal bores and sea level rise and so forth. It was really an extraordinary experience.
And it's interesting how you also talk about how people basically survive through the tides. I mean, coastal environments, that they need to be in tune with it. And a lot of us probably kind of take that for granted. You know the tide is coming in or going out, but in certain places it is so extreme, so different, that unless you are extremely careful, it could mean your life.
Yes, that's true. And of course, the parts of Alaska that fall into that category of being, some of the most extreme tides in the world. But, the Bay of Fundy, has a record tide of 54 feet 6 inches. And that's, that's not just a little bit higher than any other tide. It's 10 feet larger than the next largest tide. And there's a competing tide with that in Ungava Bay, which is about 1,500 miles north, due north of the Bay of Fundy, which is on the east side of Canada, of course. And this is an area in Ungava Bay, just south of the Arctic Circle. And they also have a record tide of 54 feet, 6 inches. And as you said, anybody can imagine that when you deal with a tide like that, it's always on your mind when you're a coastal person, when you're a fisherman or you're a surfer or you're kayaking in those kinds of waters. One of the interesting things about the Bay of Fundy is that you don't see recreational boats out in the bay. It's really pretty much just commercial boats because it's just too tough to deal with the tides.
In the latter part of the book, you talk about harnessing the energy of the tides and efforts ongoing. But what was also interesting, because that is something that is being talked about in Alaska, is there's great opportunities, but things that possibly haven't been thought about is, one, the challenge of the technology, but also the effects to the environment and the effects to, say, coastal communities.
Yeah, it's a many-layered, issue. And as a marine conservationist, I actually started this research as a naysayer of tidal energy for environmental reasons. But you know, in my research, I completely came around, and I'm an advocate of it now. I don't think it's a silver bullet, and I think it needs to be done appropriately in appropriate places. But I think it's a viable part of the clean energy picture. And as you say, you know, there are a lot of places around the world that are considering it carefully right now, and in fact have devices in the water that are producing electricity, not generally large devices, but experimental size devices. And up in the Cook Inlet, I know that there are already devices in the water up there, and where I live in the San Juan Islands, there are a number of places that they are considering putting devices in the water. Where I went to the Orkney Islands, north of Scotland, as part of that chapter that explores this, and that's where they're doing the most experiments on with tide energy and wave energy in that case. And it's really extraordinary what's going on there. And then I went to Chile as well, and they have tremendous tide energy resources and a lot of incentive to develop tide energy, but nothing in the water yet. But I imagine they will have soon.
And also in your travels, you visited places which are getting inundated by the rise in sea level and changes. Maybe you could speak a little bit about that and what the experience was like, using, for example, the community you went to in Panama.
Yes. So for that chapter on what I call Ancient and Future Seas that deals with sea level rise, I went to, as you said, the San Blas Islands. They're just on the east side of Panama, and they stretch almost down to Colombia. There's about 350 islands, very low-lying coral islands. And although they don't have large tides there in the Caribbean, in this case it's 10 to 12 inches, these islands are so low-lying that the people who live there, the Cunayala Indians, that the tide is virtually always at their ankles. And these little islands are crowded with huts, thatched huts, and in an extraordinary high tide, the tide is in their huts, in their villages, and they know that in the next 50 years, if sea level rises 3 feet, as it's conservatively estimated to do, they will lose all their islands. And there's 35,000 Cunayala Indians living there, and they are making plans to move. And then I also went to Venice, Italy, which is kind of on the other end of the spectrum, a classic city that's iconic in terms of its culture and art. And it has been dealing with tide flooding since it was founded in the 6th century. And it's been exacerbated recently, partly because of groundwater extraction, but also, of course, because of sea level rise. And today, San Marco Square floods 70 times a year. And they are building gates at the head of their lagoon to stop the tide. And so, of course, there's a lot of coastal cities that are dealing with this around the world. And these were two examples that I used in the book, and went there, of course, and talked to them and talked about the difference in how they're dealing with it, how they view it, and what their long-term solutions are.
And that was something that hit me, was with respect to Venice. We certainly hear about it going underwater, so to speak, but your book actually explains well kind of what's going on there, and the fact that the people just kind of adjust to it. It's just part of everyday life.
Yeah, I was. It was interesting to be there, and it's a walking city, and everybody owns rubber boots, as they do up in Alaska, and some people own hip waders, and there's a bookstore called Aqua Alta, which is at the lowest part of the city, and it floods, 70 plus times a year, but it never closes. So when you go in there, you use your rubber boots and you browse the books, and the books are all up raised in bathtubs and gondolas and kayaks and crowded to the ceiling. But and the guy that owns it just barks at people when the tide is in, saying, don't splash and don't make any waves. But so it's, you know, I often say that they deal with the tides there the way, you know, where I live, we deal with the rain, where you live as well. You know, it's just part of life. And in fact, where we are here, we rarely wear rain gear. It's just, you know, you just get wet from place to place, and that's just part of living here. But and that's the way they are. They know, they everybody knows what the tide is doing every day. And they know if it's going to be especially high, there are texts they get and sirens that sound throughout the city, and people wear their rubber boots, and they know the routes through the city that keep them on the highest ground, just like somebody in Seattle would know, you know, where to drive during rush hour traffic. And in fact, after a 25-year public process to see what they're going to do about the tides, now they decided to have a resilient attitude towards it, meaning they would live with some flooding, and that they would build these gates to prevent only the highest kinds of flooding.
And actually, let me read a little section here toward the end of your book, where you were being guided through Venice by Mattia Balboni.
Mm-hmm.
And something that he said that stood out to me about the fact that they are putting in these gates and things are going to change. And he says, for me, the tide is part of the city in the same way that the Northern Lights are part of the Netherlands or Niagara Falls is part of Canada. When my friends visit from Europe, the tide is one of the things I show them, and they think it's incredible. I'll lose something if we stop the tide, but I know I'll gain something, too. I won't have to wake up at 2 in the morning for fear that high tide is in my living room. And I thought that was just interesting perspective of, you know, there are many people who probably this is irritating to, but to others it's a part of their life that they don't want to lose.
That's right. Yeah, it's really fascinating, and it kind of speaks to what I discovered everywhere in one way or another about people's relationship with the tide. When I was up in the Arctic and spent time with a man named Lukasi Napaluk, who's a Inuit elder, and I went actually down underneath the ice with him where they go when the tide is out during extreme tides and to hunt for fresh blue mussels during the wintertime. And in his view, the tide was a living entity. It was as he felt as close to the tide as he did to his brother or sister, and so it's and for the Kunayala Indians, who I described down there in San Blas, I mean they have two views of the tide. One is a traditional view that tell them the tide is a spiritual visitor from another dimension, come to check up on the village, and if it sees that everything's okay, it recedes as it normally does. But if it's not okay, it stays. And so that's a perspective on sea level rise and the tide. And, of course, they also have, within their community, scientists that tell them, you know, the story of sea level rise and so forth. So they can entertain both those views at once. And in some ways, modern culture isn't so good at looking at those things or allowing all those views to happen at once.
Do you feel this experience changed you in any way? I mean, I imagine it was quite an adventure.
Yeah, it definitely did, and on a lot of different levels. I mean, one is just the value in anyone, in one of our lives, that we, you know, digging deeply into something and what that brings and the rewards of it that are always surprising and rich. And so that happened, of course, and also meeting the people and being moved by the generosity of people. And then also just feeling closer to the world, you know, because this is an extraordinary phenomenon, of course, the tides. It's a big part of our lives. I even, you know, in the end felt that, you know, it's not just what we call coastal people that are influenced by this, but really with a planet that's 75% ocean, there's nobody that's not coastal. You know, somebody in Ohio is almost as coastal as anybody in California, with this huge amount of water moving around the planet.
So what is your, are you working on anything else now, taking a little hiatus before the next project, or?
Yes, I'm thinking about other projects, but as I told my agent, I said, I'm dating, but I'm not getting married yet.
A little too much. So coming up this Friday, you're giving a presentation at the Ketchikan Public Library. What can people expect during that presentation?
Well, I tell stories about the tide and about my experiences, and I have lots of great images of the travel. And then I also made a film to demonstrate some aspect of the tide, resonance, in fact, and about that the tide ultimately is about resonance, which is vibration, or how something vibrates in response to something else. And I made a short film to demonstrate that with musicians and bouncing salt and cans, and so it's fun. And then questions and answers.
Okay, sounds great. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I really appreciate the time, Maria. I'm looking forward to getting back up there. It's been a while.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much for joining me. And that presentation coming up this Friday, I believe it's at 6:30 p.m. I don't know if you know that.
I'm not sure.
That's my guess at the top of my head. They're usually at 6:30, but I'll check that out and make sure it's on our calendar correctly. But again, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Maria. Have a great day.
You too. Jonathan White, he's author of the new book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Again, that presentation coming up this Friday at the Ketchikan Public Library.